The meaning of dandelions. From The Secret Language of Plants. By Andrina. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 7. The Fifth Year. Harry had never been more confused in his life. First, the Dementors. There were Dementors in Little Whinging. It wasn't a bad place for Dementors to be, because Harry suspected no one was truly happy there, but they clashed horribly with the decor, and none of the neighbors would accept them. Also, he understood that Dementors were not given to roam around freely, so. Second, Harry had cast a Patronus to keep the Dementors at bay. He had saved not only his own life, but his cousin Dudley's. He had gotten a letter from the Ministry just an hour later, and Harry had no idea how he was going to explain that he didn't have his wand with him at the time, and also Dementors, so the whole underage magic thing seemed a bit extreme. You would think they would take that into account. Third, the weird cat lady down the street was a squib. What even? Fourth, to be discovered over the next few days, Dudley had taken the whole Dementor encounter pretty badly and was now pestering Harry with questions about his past behavior and what to do in life. It was an improvement over his jibes and pushing, but it was very strange because Dudley was seeking him for moral and metaphysical advice, and Harry wasn't sure that he was the best person to talk to about good and evil. Not when he didn't even know if he still had a heart. Harry was actually very calm when he went to his hearing at the Ministry. By now he had figured that the Ministry did whatever it wanted, and trials were just an occasion to put on formal robes. It was out of Harry's hands, and that was kind of freeing, knowing there was nothing you could do to change the outcome. At least nothing legal or through the usual channels. Harry wanted nothing more than to be expelled. Given that everyone was ignoring the freaking presence of soul-eating monsters when accusing Harry of reckless behavior, Harry had figured that for once the Ministry's interest allied with his own. Boy, was he wrong. He should have known by now that nothing good ever came from the Ministry or wizards in general.
"Mr. Potter," said the witch with a shrill voice. She didn't pronounce the P as much as popped it from her mouth. "Has demonstrated erratic, aggressive behavior."
"Well, you're not wrong, lady."
"Mr. Potter displays absolute disregard for rules and regulations, and this infraction is but the latest example of a long list of violations. His contempt for any figure of authority is frankly alarming."
Would they give him a signed copy of this? Fred and George would be so jealous, and Sirius would find it pretty funny, too.
"He has exhibited violent tendencies inside and outside educational institutions, enough that his schoolmates, good, honest young witches and wizards, I must say, consider him a threat to their personal safety. Not only that, but his school performance is so abysmal, one must wonder if he is truly a wizard, or we are facing a case of infringement and illegitimate appropriation of wizarding culture and objects."
"What?"
"Now, Miss Umbridge, this tribunal is not judging the defendant's school performance."
"My apologies," said the woman, who did not look sorry in the least.
To Harry's bewilderment, some wizards had taken notes at her last words.
"But I do believe it is pertinent. It is my intention to prove before this tribunal that Mr. Potter lacks the mental stability required for social interaction, and that his delusions of persecution, like his claims of the return of the Dark Lord and more recently of a Dementor attack in a muggled town, make him a threat to himself and to those nearby."
The silence that followed these words was heavy. Percy Weasley, who had been taking notes dutifully and who had not made eye contact with Harry at all, paused now to look at the woman as if she were saying something fascinating.
"Mr. Potter's insanity has always been manifest, from his assertion of the good character of the werewolf Remus J. Lupin to his later declaration of the innocence of the mass murderer Sirius Black. It is for this reason that I believe that Mr. Potter cannot be allowed to remain at an educational institution where he will pose a significant threat to the young witches and wizards that rightfully attend the place, especially when his wizard status is yet to be evidenced."
Someone coughed at these last words, apparently only finding fault at the doubts over Harry's wizard status and not his supposed insanity. The woman went on unconcerned.
"I find it my duty to call for Mr. Potter's admittance into the long-term ward in St. Mungo's, where he may find the help he so obviously needs."
An asylum. They wanted to commit him to an asylum. When Peter killed those muggles and made his escape, Sirius had laughed like crazy. Harry had to bite his tongue now not to do the same. Harry was not sent to an asylum, because, quite conveniently, Dumbledore came in to bring some sense to the courtroom. McGonagall came, too, and made a passionate defense of Harry's character that took him by surprise, because he had always thought the woman saw him as little more than a source of trouble.
Yet she spoke of how the Ministry had caused his trauma to begin with when they took him forcefully from his home, true, and how Harry often defended other students, also true, now that she mentioned it, and had given proof of a generous character. He didn't know about that. Just like that, Harry was acquitted. The Prophet did not sound very happy about it, though, bemoaning over 2.5 pages of the dangers good-bred wizards and witches would be facing in Hogwarts with Harry Potter present. On his first day in Hogwarts, Dumbledore called Harry to talk to him, although weirdly he spoke with his back to Harry, and so did McGonagall, face-to-face, and Hagrid, and Severus, who made as if he had just found Harry by chance, and Flitwick, who also completely randomly happens to be walking there. Basically, every single one of Harry's teachers, he was not taking runes or arithmancy, with the exception of Professor Sinistra, who did not like Harry, and Trelawney, who never knew what was going on any given day. Even Charity Burbage, the professor of Muggle Studies, came to talk to him because, as she put it, she knew the Muggle lingo. They all had variations of the same message.
Professor Umbridge,
your DATA teacher, that ministry woman,
the poisonous toad,
was here and keeping her malevolent eyes on Harry, so please, Potter, Harry my boy, Harry, for all you hold dear, please be on your very best behavior, because they had no doubt she would try something else. And as horrible as she is, remember that Shere Khan roams outside, Severus had said, which was an oddly poetic way to say that the officially recognized dark wizard was Voldemort, and he was not in Hogwarts, so technically Harry was safer inside than out. Remus reluctantly agreed, because dear Lord, Voldemort was back. No one had been expecting that. Harry went to sit on the roof next to the aviary. It was quiet there, removed from the school. It was a good place to go be by yourself. Rufflefantinus, Draco's eagle owl, immediately came to sit next to Harry, and he petted him absentmindedly. It was a beautiful owl, but also a bit of a jerk. Harry was pretty sure that Rufflefantinus didn't care about Harry petting him. He just wanted to claim the spot from the other owls. The thing about the roof was that it put such an obvious distance between Harry and the problems below that it gave him some much-needed clarity. Below was Umbridge and her plan to have Harry institutionalized. Why? What had he ever done to her? But here he could see that Umbridge was but one problem. Voldemort was another. Severus had seemed quite worried about it, and he would know, wouldn't he? Only not, because Harry supposed Voldemort wasn't broadcasting his plans to all of his followers, but still, he trusted Severus's judgment. Plus, Harry wasn't in any rush to meet Voldemort again. He'd had enough with the last meeting. Umbridge, Voldemort, they were so big that they overshadowed everything else. You have to go far, far away, or up in this case, to see that there were other players. Dumbledore hadn't gone to Remus's trial. He was nice to Harry, and he had given him the cloak, but he didn't do anything about Remus going to Azkaban. The next year, in the hearing for Harry's adoption, a word from Dumbledore about the Weasleys would have helped their case, but he didn't go, and of course no one expected him to because he was the headmaster and obviously very busy. Yet he turned up later in the corridors to stop any other pure-blood Death Eater family from trying their luck, which was convenient and helpful, but not too helpful. The one time Harry was really close to leaving Hogwarts, that was the time Dumbledore came. Harry didn't want to think badly of him because he was Dumbledore, nice Dumbledore, and he had helped. Harry didn't particularly want to be locked in St. Mungo's either. Again and again, year after year, Dumbledore helped him with the Dursleys and the Ministry. Dumbledore was an ally, he had to be, he was good, and he helped. It wasn't his fault that his help was never quite good enough, and the idea brought tears to Harry's eyes, but the thing was, Harry never had control of where his thoughts went. With Dumbledore, they unerringly veered in the same direction, questioning his benevolent acts. Perhaps that was why he didn't tell him about the new scar. Perhaps Harry was so broken, so rotten inside, that he couldn't tell good and kindness anymore. Maybe like Voldemort, he was repulsed by it. Harry went to tell the basilisk the schedule for the choir, but something had happened during the summer. It was harder to listen for it and harder to understand. The whistles that once came so easily to his lips now trembled and wavered. Still, he thought the basilisk understood. Harry had been giving it lessons for the last 2 years because it couldn't rely on Harry forever to tell it about the castle. Now that he thought about it, he could maybe ask one of the ghosts to go talk to it. Things were oddly similar to his first year. There were whispers, and not quite whispers, saying that Harry was crazy. Plus, he got detention the very first day of class.
Mr. Potter, I will not have you spreading lies and rumors whose only purpose is to scare people.
Of course, Professor. Sometimes Harry could make his voice sound like honey and lemon. Sweet, but with something acerbic in it.
Let's all just close our eyes and hope very strongly that Voldemort doesn't kill us.
I'm sure that will work. 20 points from Gryffindor, Mr. Potter, and detention.
But unlike the first year, there was a viciousness in the air, a sense that they were fighting for blood. Speaking of which, Umbridge had him write lines with his own blood. Harry couldn't believe his eyes as he saw the red scratch appear on the back of his hand.
Is something the matter, Mr. Potter?
Well, your quill hurts me when I write,
answered Harry, who had been raised in the knowledge that he shouldn't be hurt if it could be avoided. Vaccinations and alcohol on scratched knees, yes. Torture, no.
A little pain helps with maximum retention of the lesson, Umbridge said with that fake sweet tone of hers, always speaking as if she had your best interests at heart. Her smile was so smug, though, so pleased at the idea of his pain.
Go on.
But Harry did not continue writing lines because, as already stated, he had been raised in the belief that children in general, and him in particular, should not be hurt. He stared at her as if she had just unhinged her lower jaw, eaten a whole rabbit, and was now spitting out the fur while she chewed. Harry had felt a lot of pain in his short life, even the Cruciatus curse, but never, not even once, had he thought of bringing that pain to himself. Even when he heard about Remus going to Azkaban and Harry wanted to die, he wanted to escape and not be there, but not to actually go through the whole process of dying. Already done that, he did not recommend it. It felt counterintuitive to do the torturer's work for them. He didn't write any more words. He looked at his hands and remembered how whenever he got hurt, Remus would put a band-aid on it and kiss it better and tap it with his wand. Now that he thought about it, he probably didn't even need the band-aids, but he had liked them. They had cartoons. His favorites were the one with the hippopotamus.
Mr. Potter, you must complete your detention.
Umbridge raised her brows to indicate the waiting quill and parchment, upon which there was only half a line written.
Right. I don't know how to write, Professor.
It was now her turn to stare. But Harry had been on the receiving end of much stronger stares. He would say that he had looked Voldemort in the eyes, but mostly he was thinking of McGonagall. They pushed and pulled for an hour, with Harry insisting adamantly that he had never learned how to write, never mind that he seemed to be able to do it just a minute ago. They kept at it until blessedly McGonagall came to his rescue, entering the office asking where he was. After seeing the quill and its intended use, she took Harry with her, warning that she would talk to Dumbledore about Umbridge's choice of discipline. She kept her hand on the back of Harry's robe until they reached the portrait of the fat lady. It didn't matter. He got another detention the next day, this time to wash and polish all the ornamental dishes in Umbridge's office until they gleamed. Ron had told him that manual labor was demeaning, and that was why they used it as a punishment. Hermione had muttered something about house elves in the background, but Harry didn't mind it that much. Sure, it was a bother and magic was quicker, but cleaning things by hand also showed some degree of respect. Not his clothes or his shoes, maybe, but his firebolt, for sure, or the instruments used in potions.
"Mr. Potter, you must stop telling lies," said Umbridge, in what she no doubt thought was a tone of sympathy. "No dark wizard has returned. Deep down, I am sure you know the truth. You're a poor, confused child looking for attention. It's not your fault that you have been deceived so, but, Mr. Potter, you have to try to see the truth."
"Right," said Harry, swiping over a pink plate. He wondered if McGonagall had noticed them and what she thought of Umbridge's love for cats.
"You must realize, Mr. Potter, the influences you have around you are not helpful at all. Professor Dumbledore, for example."
Harry snickered. Just like with Voldemort, they assumed a loyalty to Dumbledore he did not feel. He didn't hate the man, he just wasn't starting a fan club, that was for sure. For a great wizard, he didn't seem that competent to Harry.
"And the werewolf," Umbridge continued. "Merlin knows what kind of twisted lies he puts in your head."
"She's only trying to get a rise out of you. Don't listen. Ignore her."
"Half-breeds like him have always been a danger to good wizards. They are the snake hidden in the grass, waiting to strike over the innocent."
Harry got the mental image of pure-blood Gregory Goyle skipping over a meadow with a Greek dress like Eurydice. This is what happens when you encourage children's curiosity. They grow up to become teenagers with critical thinking and a sense of humor.
"You have been raised by an animal. A tragedy, it wasn't your fault. But you must strive to rejoin society, Mr. Potter. Abandon your savage ways."
The dish he was cleaning cracked and crumbled to the floor in 7 pieces. Upon departing, Umbridge gave him some last words.
"I will do whatever it takes to make you see reason, Mr. Potter."
Mostly it seemed as if Dolores Umbridge was doing her utmost to provoke a mental breakdown in Harry, and as a secondary project, make as many people as possible profoundly miserable. It went like this. Harry liked flying. It was one of the few things he was good at.
So Umbridge banned Quidditch teams, and once they were reapproved, ensured that Harry wouldn't be on them, with some excuse or other. Harry shrugged it off and said to himself that at least he didn't have to worry about hiding his new scar when they were in the showers. Harry liked going to Hogsmeade, not exactly, but the change of scenery was nice. Umbridge ensured he had detention every Saturday, and after October, simply revoked his privilege and prohibited him entirely from going. Harry liked music. All music was banned except for a short list that the ministry considered educative and with good traditional values. Flitwick, who was in charge of the choir, had a fit over it. Severus looked ready to strangle someone if he had to hear one more time what good witches want.
A clean kitchen to pot a cauldron, a good friend that praises her cakes, a nice black robe that is not too short, and a wizard that looks at her.
Harry wasn't really affected by this last ban. His Walkman worked in strange and mysterious ways. When they were in History of Magic, Harry would either read or listen to music. Ron always scooted closer, and Harry gave him the other earphone, and they listened together, and no one seemed to notice. But if he tried to do the same at the Gryffindor table in the Great Hall, the music seemed to leak out, and people could hear it up to 3 seats down in every direction. The Ravenclaws had yet to figure out the source of the music they could sometimes hear, and it was driving them crazy. If he sat to listen to music in the East Wing of the 3rd floor, that same music could be heard in the West Wing 2nd floor. Draco sometimes went there to work for this very reason. A big fan of Ray Charles, Draco had turned out to be. Filch was convinced it was Peeves' fault somehow, and the poltergeist found it so funny he had yet to contradict him. Harry could have put up with all of this easily. It wasn't much worse than all the restrictions in his first year, and he had books and music and 2 good friends. But the worst part was how they were trying to isolate him. Not just Umbridge, but the ministry and the world in general, everyone against him, or so it felt. Seamus called him a liar to his face. Ron and Ginny got a letter from Percy advising them to stay away from him. Severus passed him a note, via detention to Ron, who later found it in his pocket, that they could not talk, as he suspected he was under heavy surveillance and had his ladle in too many cauldrons to even hazard a guess at who was spying on him, and flywings were expensive and only for emergencies. Harry could barely risk writing to Sirius and Remus for fear of his letters being inspected and giving them away. Dumbledore didn't look at or speak to Harry at all after that initial talk. According to Fred and George, who had very lax definitions of privacy, only Hermione and the girls from the Quidditch team were entitled to it, they had overheard during the summer that they were afraid that Harry had a connection to Voldemort that could be used to spy on them.
"I really don't feel any connection with that man," Harry said, and ardently wished it were so. They really, really, really had nothing in common, though. For starters, Harry had hair and a nose. Hermione had to hide her laugh behind a book.
"You're not trying hard enough, Harry," said George. "Expand your horizons and wicked potential."
"Right. Could we interest you in a bit of murder? A DIDA professor, perhaps?" proposed Fred.
"You know, if you kill a DIDA teacher, it doesn't really count. Ask Charlie." They meant it as a joke, but Harry couldn't laugh. He could see himself becoming a murderer all too well. Still, Harry had a small circle of friends, but Umbridge took that too. Students were to keep a foot and a half of space between them at all times. Most of them had grown up with centimeters, and for a glorious afternoon, Fred convinced everyone that the standard measurement was Filch's left foot, and they were not allowed to form groups. This made teaching potions and herbology ridiculously troublesome. At least in the latter, they had open grounds beyond the greenhouses, but in the dungeons, they had people attending class practically standing inside the supplies closet to be able to follow the rule. Umbridge alternated between punishing Harry and the school in general. She got Professor Trelawney sacked and had some very nasty words for Charity Burbage, the professor of Muggle Studies. People learned to quickly exit the room whenever Umbridge and McGonagall were close. Then, at some point in early November, she took a look at Harry and drafted a new decree about physical appearance, detailing the state of robes and how much skin one could show at any time, and the restrictions on hairdressing and length. Harry's hair was way past his shoulders now. He hadn't cut it since the summer when he was stolen from his home. It had taken him 1.5 years to discover the magical barbershop in Hogwarts, and by then he had grown used to it. The long hair meant hiding the scar better, and short or long, it was always disheveled. In fact, now that it had grown so much, it was easier to manage. It had the additional advantage of offering a place to store his wand when he needed both arms, since he could use the wand to keep his hair fixed in a bun. It wasn't that strange. Luna did it, too. Umbridge had noticed, and decreed that all male students should have hair no longer than 1.5 inches, which was ridiculously short. Also, what was this woman's problem with the decimal system? It was, in fact, the only decree she didn't get to implement, because 2 hours later, the Slytherin prefects were pounding at her door. Draco was pink-faced and clutching a ruler, Imperial and decimal. And the head girl, Shiruchi something,
was positively vibrating with rage at the front of a long line of students with less than straight hair. Lee Jordan and his magnificent head of curls was there too, despite being a Gryffindor, as well as a couple of second-year Ravenclaws with cute short dreadlocks. Harry did a lot of reading that year. He read the DADA book from cover to cover, probably the only person to do it because even Hermione couldn't deal with such a frustrating textbook. The truth was that Harry found the premise interesting, a less violent approach to the dark arts, advocating for peaceful solutions. He liked that. He didn't know how you could enforce it, because a creature that feeds on human blood won't be very open to a change of diet, but it was worth exploring, just as the non-magical solutions proposed in Magical Review. So Harry read. When he was reading, he didn't have to think about anything else, about the gloom that was taking over Hogwarts and the horrible things the Prophet published about him, about the smell of spoiled milk and the bitter regret he got whenever he thought that he had brought nothing but trouble to the Weasleys. He didn't have to think of Draco either, and that horrible conversation they had had at the beginning of semester, because Draco's father had been there, kneeling before Voldemort. By the end of November, Harry had reread every novel he owned. He was down to the informative non-fiction books, like the one on plant symbolism he already knew by heart. He had a few more books like that at the bottom of his trunk. Having learned that he liked reading, Sirius was trying to help by anonymously sending him all kinds of random muggle books. There was one about motorcycles that Harry didn't particularly like, and another about spices, history, cultivation, and uses that was interesting, and finally a little gem called Resistance Through the Ages. It was a history book, short and with many pictures, and Harry hadn't looked much at it because it felt like a very long leaflet rather than an actual book, but he was down to nothing now until either Sirius or Severus could anonymously send him more. The book was divided into multiple short chapters, and in each one it explained in merely a page about some sort of injustice. And then on the next two pages it talked about someone who rose to fight it. Two pages with photographs, with too little space to explain the drama of the fight for India's independence or civil rights in America, but it could give you ideas all the same, especially when you could go back and forth and compare. And there was a line in the foreword that stood out to Harry. Resistance is often framed as obedience. Umbridge was a horrible person, but a weak one, too. It had taken her until December to realize that when other teachers gave Harry detention, they were in fact giving him a reprieve and letting him sit quietly in their offices to do his homework. Flitwick also offered him chocolate-covered berries. They were very good. Severus brought him books and said nothing, still under surveillance. They could pass notes, though. Harry couldn't bring himself to write certain things, so there was a lot that went unsaid, but at least he could request books and tea. Of course, she seized on that, and soon an educational decree came announcing that the High Inquisitor would be the one exclusively responsible for administering punishments. She made Harry write more lines, although not with that quill, because Harry kept dropping it, and insisting in an earnest way that he had never been taught how to write. No wonder he was such a bad student. For all they liked to talk about the physical resemblance, people seemed to forget that Harry was the son of James. I have never, ever in my life seen a flying broom. I don't know how the house cop got up there. I don't even go to this school, Potter. She made him clean the kitty dishes. He broke two more and somehow wiped the image of another six.
It must have been the rag you gave me, Professor. I didn't do any magic. You told me not to bring my wand.
She took him down to the kitchens to wash the dishes and all the pans and pots. That night, the Great Hall could only produce sandwiches and hors d'oeuvres for dinner because Harry had managed to wash a total of three glasses and a small pot.
But they're very clean. Look, spotless.
Finally, she ordered Harry to clean the main stairs with a toothbrush. Draco found Harry late after dinner sitting idly on the third step, locked in animated conversation with a picture of a fawn.
Weren't you supposed to be cleaning this?
I'm Draco. Draco looked down at the stairs covered in mud and half-melted snow from the students that had returned from their last visit to Hogsmeade.
Here, this pot's clean.
Harry pointed at the small area between his feet. It was indeed as clean as a stair-step could be. They were alone, so Draco didn't have to pretend to despise Harry. It's not that he liked Harry. He did, he just didn't admit it. Or that they were friends. Of course they were. Harry had said so. Shut up, Draco. But that they had grown to know each other and had reached a certain familiarity that could not be shown in public. They were alone, so he didn't have to pretend about that one. He just kept pretending about the first two, though, mostly to himself. Draco sat with him and joined the conversation. Apparently Harry had been asking what it was like to walk with goat's feet. The fawn left soon after to go harass the fat lady.
Her name is Gloria Patrice. I wonder why no one calls her that.
And they were left truly alone.
Are you going back home for the holidays? Asked Harry.
Yes, of course, answered Draco slowly. He explained briefly the traditional Christmas menu, and the gnome burning, and the tossing of a house elf into the pond. He spoke with the usual careful tone that denoted that these were all magnificent activities and highly exclusive. If he didn't sound thrilled about it, it was because Draco was used to them, but everyone else should be very jealous. There was a very strange relationship based on silences and things not said. Draco didn't say certain things, and neither did Harry. And yet those things lay between them, silent but acknowledged. Things like the time Draco spoke too much and the time that Harry did too. Because it was not about Harry keeping quiet about Lucius Malfoy being a Death Eater. It was about him bluntly saying so to Draco's face. About Harry saying that, yeah, Draco's dad wasn't nice, but Draco was. And Harry had said he would consider Draco his friend, that he was going to keep doing so. Draco had no idea how to answer that. He didn't know that he could be regarded as anything other than Lucius Malfoy's son. "So, do you have any new music?" Draco said at last. "No, sorry. Nothing since the last time." Harry looked down at the supposedly clean spot on the stairs. "I'm doing more reading lately. What with the prohibition of music?" "Like you were following that ban," Draco scoffed. "He would know. They still met behind the vampire statue thrice a week. They didn't speak about that either."
"Yeah, still am reading more. Actually..."
Draco was not going to have a nice Christmas break. Draco didn't enjoy going home to his family. Harry reached into his bag.
"You may like this last book I read. It's Muggle," Harry warned. "We can put it inside none of the book's covers." "I did that all the time."
And so Draco smuggled a Muggle informative book back home. Dumbledore had imposed radio silence during summer, although Ron ignored it and did send a couple of letters to Harry. But although he had explained a little bit, and Hermione, Ginny, and the twins had later described it, Harry still wasn't prepared for the changes that had befallen the burrow. He had liked the place so much, and now they had changed it. Supposedly it was better now. They had reinforced the roof, and there was a whole other wing to the house, plus the living room that had doubled in size to be able to hold its numerous visitors. The burrow was now working as headquarters for the Order of the Phoenix. Of course, a London location would have been more convenient for the people working in the ministry, but the burrow had the added value of discretion. With all of the Weasley clan, minus Percy, plus Hermione and Harry, the room felt crowded. It wasn't long before a nurse came to tell them just that and made them wait outside and visit Arthur in groups of no more than three. A glance to the twins, who for some mysterious reason were holding a rubber chicken, and she added that they would need adult supervision. Harry only said that he was very glad that Arthur was all right, and wished him a swift recovery before quickly stepping out to give Ginny extra time with her dad. He would wait outside. He was fully aware that it was morbid, but nevertheless he wandered off to the long-term ward, to the place where Umbridge still intended to lock him up. It was actually a clean and well-lit space. Harry thought that if it had been during his first year, he wouldn't have minded being sent there. 7 minutes in, and Harry had already made a friend. And that despite spending 5 of those first 7 minutes trying to step around Gilderoy Lockhart.
"And how was your son, Harry, right? You must forgive me, my memory's not good."
"That's all right, dear."
Harry's smile was sweet and tender and so, so caring. His expression changed a bit then, trying to go for something like Sirius's dashing smile. "He's a rascal, just like his father." The woman laughed, and the floor nurse looked up sharply at them. Harry thought maybe she was going to tell him off, but she didn't say anything. She only stared as if she had just witnessed a miracle. Harry had no way to know. In all her years working in St. Mungo, the Mediwizard had not heard Alice Longbottom laugh, ever. Not even once.
"And what does Lily say about that?"
Harry had to think a bit about this before answering.
"She makes sure that Sirius and I don't spoil him rotten. She's the light of my life."
"She is a light,"
whispered Alice Longbottom. Her gaze was glazing over. Harry swallowed and made eye contact with the nurse across the room that was still staring at them. He didn't know what was coming over Alice.
"She died. Both of you."
Alice had tears in her eyes. Harry was struck by how kind this poor woman was and how much Neville resembled her.
"But not Harry. The poor baby. He's the same age as Neville," she sniffled. "My boy. Please don't let him be hurt. I'll take anything, just Neville."
"He's all right," said Harry quickly and assertively to cut Alice's increasingly fat and desperate words.
Alice's wet eyes focused once more on him. In this moment, Harry wished he could melt onto the floor and leave the room in puddle form. But he had chosen to come here. He couldn't run now. He would see this task to the end.
"He's in Gryffindor, just like Harry," he said, squeezing Alice's hand.
"They were born in the same year, just a day of difference. Neville came the 30th.
He's the oldest.
And he treats Harry like a younger brother, always making sure he doesn't get in trouble. Harry lied easily. Alice seemed to calm down at this, or rather she was not scared anymore, even if she was agitated. Her lips moved without uttering a word.
He treats... James, I'm sorry. Please forgive me, my memory is not so good.
I understand, Alice. Harry put his hand over hers. What else could he do? He had cried for the parents he didn't meet, but this... When Voldemort had cast the Cruciatus on him, it had hurt, and Harry had wished he could die, but it was nothing to the pain and loathing he was feeling now. Harry wanted to leave. He wanted to leave and not look back and keep walking until he was surrounded by Weasleys and the sound of the twins' jokes drowned out everything else. He wanted to go hug Mrs. Weasley and fall asleep in his bed at the Burrow. Instead, he offered his arm and took Alice Longbottom for a stroll, her thin, fragile hand in the crook of his elbow. Neville had inherited his father's hands, not hers. Harry discovered that despite their absence, despite telling himself that he hadn't met his parents, he did know them. He knew them enough that Alice could tell when he was being truthful and when he was being playful. She would swat him in the arm and laugh and say that did not happen. And Harry would admit maybe not, because Remus told Lily and she stopped them. But otherwise, the fictitious Harry he was talking about, the Harry that could have been, would have been on top of an adult flying broomstick when he was age 5. Alice laughed 5 more times before Ron came looking for Harry. On his way out, they came across Neville and his grandmother, which would have been extremely awkward. The grandmother threw Harry a terrible look of disapproval, but he had spent almost an hour with Alice by then. There was a connection.
Neville! James was just here. He told me how you won the House Cup, my little boy. I love you so much.
They visited Mr. Weasley 2 more times during the Christmas break, and on both occasions Harry talked to Alice. She smiled at him and lightened up, and that was good, but she also turned gray and anxiously tried to warn him of what was going to happen to save himself and Lily. Alice was an incredible woman. It was with that thought in mind that Harry went to find Hermione and took her outside the Burrow to sit on the fence that marked the border of the property. It was cold, and they were alone, and it was only there, outside the house, that Harry could ask why she was here.
Harry, you asked me to come. I mean at the Burrow. What, you don't want me to be here?
Harry knew about using anger to deflect questions when you didn't want to talk about something. He looked at her, the brilliant muggle-born witch.
Will you teach me how to braid my hair?
What? Hermione's mouth moved without sound for a minute. Maybe Harry's brain had made another big leap, too big for people to follow, but her hair was long and wild just as his, and it seemed like braiding would be an effective way to keep it out of the way. It would also mean having something to do with their hands. Hermione taught him how to make a simple braid and a French braid and a reverse French braid, and to take just 2 strands from your temples and sort of use them to tie everything down. And while she was doing that, she also explained the reason why she was spending Christmas at the Burrow. Harry thought that she was actually grateful that he had noticed and asked, even if she really didn't want to talk about it. He felt a pang at the thought of his friend Olivia, who also had big curly hair, impossible to braid, and who, just like Hermione, was never afraid to fight monsters. After Christmas and the mass breakout of Azkaban, the official storyline of the Ministry lost its strength, and they answered by redoubling their attacks on Harry and Dumbledore. Every day there was a new story of something outrageous and perverted Harry had supposedly done. It was reaching a stage where people in Gryffindor, and some Ravenclaws, started to laugh it off, even if most of the school still looked at Harry with something like apprehension. He had always been very weird. Even if the papers were exaggerating, who was to say that there wasn't some truth? On the other hand, this was Harry, and everyone knew he was a hopeless wizard. He was not performing dark arcane rituals late at night in the Forbidden Forest, and he certainly was not enticing young, impressionable witches. How Katie and Angelina and Alicia had laughed at that. Neither was he eating snakes' hearts, nor had he bitten a schoolmate in the manner of the werewolves. So people weren't quite sure what to make of the prophet. Fred and George, and sometimes Ginny, joked about Harry's eating habits. It was horrible, but also a welcome break. Neville seemed to have been infected by the same madness that ailed Harry. He started to fight whatever dared criticize Harry within his earshot, and he gave Seamus a bloody nose when he repeated that, yes, Harry was a lunatic that ought to be locked up somewhere. It would be easy to think that Neville was paying a debt, just as Harry was still paying his debt with Draco. But just as Harry had done in his first year, once Neville got started defending a person, he easily moved on to defending an idea.
which is why Neville Longbottom jinxed those girls that had taken Luna's scarf and kept calling her Loony. The girls shrieked and ran away with their hair sprouting snake heads that were biting their faces and necks. Neville avoided detention because although he had performed the spell in clear daylight in the middle of a busy corridor, no one could believe their own eyes. Slowly, the fifth year learned to drop the word crazy from their vocabulary. The thing is that Severus had realized he was being spied on as soon as he returned to Hogwarts from his extremely busy summer. This wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because it allowed you to manipulate your enemies from the comfort of your own home, feeding them misinformation while you were in your slippers. But there were so many of them. Someone in the Ministry remembered that Severus Snape used to be a Death Eater, and given the claims from both Dumbledore and Harry Potter that the Dark Lord had returned, they decided to keep Severus under surveillance in case he suddenly felt like sharing Voldemort's location with the world. Then there were the other people in the Ministry who thought that Dumbledore was raising an army to depose Fudge. What a thought, though. And Severus would obviously participate in it because he owed his freedom to Dumbledore. So they were listening, too, in case Severus was overcome by the urge to explain in detail Dumbledore's plans for a coup d'etat. Aloud, two different departments were doing this because bureaucracy. And, because of course there was an and, nothing in his life was simple, there were people in the Order who still distrusted him, and who had taken it upon themselves to keep an eye on him in case he wasn't completely loyal to Dumbledore. True, he wasn't, but he was not about to go to Voldemort if that's what they thought, and frankly, Fletcher was still an appallingly bad spy, and Moody wasn't one to talk when he had allowed himself to be kidnapped for almost a whole year. In this equation, the only people who apparently were happy with Severus and trusted him completely were Lord Voldemort himself, which miffed Severus extremely. The one person actually known for murdering his own followers at a whim and imposing terrible punishments for betrayal and disobedience, Karkaroff had not emerged unscathed from the latest run-in with his fellow Death Eaters, and he would not last alive much longer. He was the one who thought Severus was a loyal man. If freaking Voldemort was happy with him, Severus failed to see why everyone else was so doubtful. Thankfully, no one in the Wizarding World seemed to understand the concept of security cameras, so most of these spying spells were directed towards recording sound and movement to or from a room, but certainly not image. So absolutely no one besides him was privy to the recurring image between the months of September to December of Harry James Potter sitting at his desk reading comics and sipping herbal tea. No one saw the piece of parchment they used to talk or Severus handing him books. In the end, all this surveillance wouldn't matter much, because Severus was a master spy, and he knew how to keep everyone happy. What mattered was that the poisonous toad who had inexplicably gained the minister's favor had been granted exclusive control of punishments, and he couldn't have Harry with him anymore, even in silence. What mattered was that she had forbidden professors from discussing with students anything not related to their subject. What mattered was that it had become incredibly hard talking to Harry. Plant language only took you so far. Dumbledore's dismissal was quiet. The announcement came Thursday evening, signed by the Ministry and the Board of Governors, of which Malfoy was part. They didn't cite any specific event for his dismissal, other than a general lack of quality education and concerns about the safety of students, much like they had done at the end of second year. Umbridge stepped in on Monday and immediately improved the infliction of physical punishments. She didn't go after Harry right away, which was a bit of a disappointment, and he almost felt insulted having to wait until Tuesday. Her first order as headmistress was to immediately expel Sybil Trelawney and the centaur known as Ferenz from the grounds of Hogwarts. Not to worry, though. There was a new divination teacher ready. Professor Willington looked, quite literally, like dead warmed over. He was a tall, thin man, not unlike Severus, except his hair was slicked back, and he sported deep blue shadows under his eyes. He spoke a bit of the dismal state of their education, and then the class started. They were going to learn how to interpret dreams. The art of deciphering the meaning of dreams was a delicate process available only to a few chosen. It went something like this. I dreamt that I was flying.
That's obviously signals to your strivings for competence and a higher state of success. Your quest for the utmost and most magnificent quality on your endeavors. Very good. Mr.
Thomas. Dean Thomas, sir.
Thomas? I don't recall having heard that name before. Who are your parents?
I'm Muggleborn, sir. Or so we think.
Well, flying often points to an unplaced sense of entitlement and depraved ambition. The unquenched thirst for a position over which you have no legitimate claim. We must be careful of aspiring to be above our status.
And then they had to tell each other a dream and write an interpretation. If you dare to write something good of a half-blood, or, Merlin forbid, a muggle-born, you got a failing grade. Hermione pointed out, very calmly, that since Harry had given his interview to the Quibbler during Christmas break and outside of Hogwarts, it evaded the headmistress's authority. So Harry escaped punishment, but Hermione got detention for speaking out of turn. She had never gotten detention, never in her life. Given that it was her very first offense in her academic career, she should not suffer the most extreme punishments. She quoted the regulation number stating this fact, looking at Umbridge straight in the eye. Harry could kiss her. Ron did give her a kiss on the cheek, and George hugged her mouth smugly, "She's ours," to the Ravenclaw table. The Quibbler was banned, which guaranteed its widespread reading, but Harry got his punishment anyway. They said it had been Dennis Creevy's fault, but Harry rejected that thought. It was Umbridge. She had the wand and the power. All poor Dennis had was a copy of the Quibbler in clumsy fingers, and the bad luck of dropping it when Vincent Crabbe was nearby. Vincent was not the keenest nor the sharpest student. When Harry pushed Dennis aside and said that it was his backpack, Vincent didn't question it. Umbridge cast Flagello a total of 12 times, followed by something called Tormento that rattled his bones.
"I suspect that before the end of the course, you'll have changed your mind, Mr. Potter, and that you will manifest it publicly,"
said Umbridge over Harry's exhausted panting.
"I am doing all in my hands to show you the truth and redeem you of your ways, but if you fail,"
she looked down sadly,
"the Ministry may have to reconsider the case about your mental stability, Mr. Potter. Flagello. And there is, of course, the matter of your owls. Flagello. Whatever will happen if you don't manage to pass any of them, Flagello. It would be up to me to decide if you may continue your education, Mr. Potter. What do you think?"
Harry at last got enough air in his lungs to form words.
"I hope you don't deprive me of these lovely chats, Dolores."
"I'll still so cheeky. Tormento."
Bravery is not about facing your enemies. Not always. Seamus Finnegan got up and apologized to Neville for his callousness, talking about crazy people in St. Mungo, and then he apologized to Harry and said that you couldn't believe everything you read in the Prophet. Because he did that in the middle of the Great Hall, Umbridge gave him detention for disrupting the lunch hour. It wasn't good. Harry waited for him at the end of the corridor to Umbridge's office with a bottle of water and a candy bar. He helped Seamus climb the stairs back to the tower and insisted it was all right, and Seamus did not have a pile of hippogriff manure instead of brains, and really, Harry hadn't minded his words that much, and appreciated his apology. No need to apologize again. Harry had done all of his crying a long time ago. He had been really close to Dementors. He had suffered through the Cruciatus with Voldemort and still got his bearings right away to make his escape. After a session with Umbridge, his arms and legs shook for a bit. Okay, close to 2 hours, maybe three. And yes, it hurt. But the thought of pain hurts more than pain itself, if that makes sense. Quidditch practice could also hurt, but they didn't mind it because it was fun, and so they didn't think about the pain. Umbridge had cast Flagello on Seamus 6 times. His hands were shaking so much he could not keep hold of his wand. Harry helped him sit on the landing so he could cry a bit before climbing the last part to the tower. Ron could be a real ass half of the time, but Harry had never known such a true friend. At the end of the class, when all potions had been bottled and tagged, Ron told him to go ahead and waited for most of the class to leave before knocking down 3 cauldrons in the drawer with the silver spoons. This guaranteed that everyone in the vicinity left in a hurry.
"Weasley, 10 points from Gryffindor."
Snape didn't give him detention. Few teachers were giving them, if it meant sending the child to Umbridge.
"Yes, sir, sorry, sir," said Ron. "I didn't mean to. It's just that I'm very worried for my friend Harry, because the headmistress said that he'd better go back on his word before the end of the course, or she'll recommend his commitment to St. Mungo. And even if that doesn't work out, she won't let him come back when he fails his owls."
"Be more careful in the future, Weasley."
It was March, but Severus went to the February town of Felbrigg in Norfolk, because he had too many things in his mind to notice when a month ended before its due time. There was only a short and very nice path between the church and the manor. Severus walked there, and circled the manor 2 times before apparating away to Danby Whisk. Dan, because it was the place he went when there was danger. And Whisk sounded like a risk, and since no one knew about this, Severus was free to make as many bad jokes as he wanted. And there was another soft pop 15 seconds after Severus apparated there. From his position, Severus could see a small figure turn around over itself and then dive quickly behind a tree when it spotted Severus. He was being followed. Not by a wizard, because a wizard couldn't guess where he was apparating, but by something. Perhaps a house elf, a magical stalker, most likely. A being that would follow you wherever you went, untiring. It had no conscience, so it could not be threatened, and it could not be bribed. It knew only that it would follow you until you arrived, or returned to a certain place, or until it was called back by the wizard that had sent it. Perhaps Voldemort was finally feeling doubtful, or the ever-present suspicions of the Order had increased. The endurance of Fletcher's old hat was remarkable, or it was a pawn from the Ministry. Severus was inclined to think that this was the case. So Umbridge knew if and when the teachers went to contact Dumbledore. It didn't matter. The stalker would follow, and all it could report back was that Severus went to a small shop in Suffolk where he acquired a softcore pornographic novel and a pair of nylon tights. Nylon tights were an excellent thing, the very best thing. Severus owned over a dozen pairs, all still in their original packaging. You bought them and people's minds instantly went down a certain path. There were few objects that could provide such misdirection for such a small disbursement. Glorious thing. The number one tool for a spy. On a side of the shop, a dusty corner seldom visited even by the owner, was a small counter with writing materials and a grid full of metal slots. And here was the thing, perfectly absurd and delightfully bureaucratic. For the unreasonable price of a galleon and 11 sickles, you could buy a mailbox to send and receive messages for the next 3 years. It was unreasonable because you would have to send quite a lot of post to make the price worth it, and if you surpassed a certain size or weight, the box would reject your letter. So you would have to send quite a lot of very short, light messages to get your money's worth. It was also actually quite inconvenient because it required you going to the shop and giving the password to send and receive your mail, rather than doing it from the comfort of your own home with an owl. People would have had done with it altogether if they knew how to remove it, but no one knew exactly where the mailboxes were. They knew where the slots to the boxes were.
Over 50 locations through the United Kingdom, was what the old leaflets advertised, but not the boxes themselves.
Severus suspected either the Department of Mysteries or the TARDIS. The private mailbox system was also, because of its official status and it being developed sometime in the 19th century, ridiculously well protected. Nothing, absolutely nothing, could open the box other than the designated password. Going there was inconvenient and risky in a way, but it was better than using an owl. Owls could be followed. The flu network could be intercepted. This guaranteed that the message would remain safe until someone with a password went to retrieve it from any of the 50 slot locations. Severus could leave a message, say, in Suffolk, and Remus could go and get it somewhere in Torquay. Still, they didn't dare using it often. Severus was being watched, and Remus couldn't show his face in many places. They also wrote with a code, so if any of them were found with the message, it wouldn't reveal anything compromising. Severus was the last line of defense, and they couldn't risk revealing his identity. Today Snape wrote of the lack of sun in his garden and how a poisonous toad was ruining all his plants, particularly the new lily breed he was growing. He was thinking that the only solution would be to uproot the flower at the earliest opportunity, never mind that he didn't know where to move the lily to. It had to be moved. The whole point was to keep Harry safe and happy. Hogwarts failed in the second requisite, but with Voldemort returned, one would think the first had become more important. Only now Hogwarts wasn't safe either, and frankly Severus thought they could take the risk to go elsewhere. Maybe if they kept moving, and perhaps even managed to get Harry out of the country, would all be well. Or not well. Severus didn't kid himself about the war that was coming. That had already started. It was going to be bad. All he wanted was for Harry not to have to fight it. He had already stopped the last one. Let others fight this one. He had space for a single more line, and that was all. Severus didn't know what he could say, and so he wrote nothing. The paper was perfumed, a subtle mix of orange and caramel that he hoped would last for a few days. It took Harry longer to recover after that last session with Umbridge. In fact, the shaking stopped by the next day, but Harry felt as if he hadn't recovered at all, as if something inside him had been shaken loose. Something that spoke in Remus's voice, and Severus's, and Sirius's, and that female voice he couldn't remember. It said that he didn't have to suffer this. It said, "Go. What are you doing here? Go. Go before it gets worse. Go before Umbridge breaks you down and lets the monster loose. Go, and if you get yourself killed, that's still better than staying and becoming something else."
"Now, Mr. Potter, what did you dream?"
"I dreamt of an hourglass, Professor Willington."
"The passing of time is surely an acknowledgement of your usual juvenile and immature behavior, Mr. Potter."
"I agree, Professor. The time for adulthood was coming. Unbeknownst to him, change was brewing in Hogwarts. And he was the little confused butterfly that set it all in motion." End of chapter 7.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.